Hello and welcome once again to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined today by Harriet Russell. How are you doing, Harriet?
Good, thanks.
And how are you? Not too bad. You're going to talk to us about, well, I'm better than yesterday, because yesterday was worst press day ever. But there you go. You're going to talk to us today about your cover feature, Fighting the Cure, which is about the companies battling some of the world's deadliest diseases.
Yeah.
Bradley Gerard, who is relatively new to the IC. How are you doing, Bradley?
I'm very good, thank you. Yep, 3 weeks in. Enjoying it so far.
Good. That's good to hear. 3 weeks in. I'm 3 years now as editor, nearly, in about Excellent. 2 weeks' time. And
Good stuff.
Time flies, isn't it?
On the IC. It does.
So not yesterday, during worst press day ever, unfortunately. It felt like the day was taking forever. And it actually was. You were here, Bradley.
I was, was an interesting experience. Hopefully press days don't go on as long as that. Normally, I'm sure it's a very tight ship, usually. Just an unusual experience yesterday.
It was an anomaly. Okay. An anomaly.
Good to hear.
You're going to talk to us about news and some of the results you've done this week. So, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Welcome to your first Companies and Markets podcast. And over in the control room, along with Dom, who's manning the controls, we've got Ian Smith. How are you doing, Ian?
Fine, John. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. All right. Good. Big week in the financial sector. A lot of your insurers reporting this week. Some M&A activity there as well.
Yeah, lots going on.
Yeah. Who said finance wasn't interesting?
Not me.
Okay. Let's start with news. So, Bradley, you've looked after the news this week, and it's your first week of putting together 7 days.
It is.
The roundup of all the big stories in the world. And again, you've picked a good week, because we've had some really quite interesting stuff this week, particularly in China.
Yeah, very interesting. The People's Bank of China pretty much caught everyone, apart from itself, by surprise, really, I suppose, by devaluing its currency.
It wasn't a deliberate choice, but what it hasn't done is repegged it to the dollar, so it let it drift, which it hasn't done for a while.
Yeah, they have like a daily fix, as they call it, so there is an element, I guess, of an actual decision behind the move, because they decide at which level to fix it every day.
But this time they decided they weren't going to fix it.
Yeah, pretty much. So it dropped a bit, and it dropped again the next day, and I think it's dropped again today as well. They have actually stepped in today. The FT's covered it extensively. The People's Bank of China stepping in and trying to calm market down, saying there is no, honestly, hands up, there is no move here to devalue the currency significantly for a long period of time. But it did rattle markets on Wednesday, but I think everyone's kind of a bit more relaxed now.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good that they're relaxed. I'm not so sure, because, I mean, it doesn't explain why they let it drift rather than fixing it, as they have done over many, many years.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I suppose the one, you know, if one thinks about the reasons for weakening a currency, it might be that it would help a country's exporters.
Yep.
So perhaps China is a bit more worried about its economic growth prospects than people realise. So it could be an admission of that, possibly.
Yeah, but we've been talking about this for a long time, because, you know, China's sort of stuck with this, we're going to grow at 7% a year level, and, you know, reading around the subjects over the last few days, I think there's some people now saying actually those figures are massively inflated. Growth will be much, much lower than that.
Yeah, I mean, people sort of say, oh, 7% isn't very good for China, but it's a fantastic number compared to other countries around the world. But yes, I mean, getting reliable raw data from China is very difficult. You rely on the Chinese authorities. And obviously, you know, you could argue that about any data. The ONS is always revising data, which you could argue paints a brighter historic picture the further away from an event you step, but the data in China is hard to, you know, it's hard to know how reliable it is, and perhaps this devaluation of the currency is a sign that there's some concerns.
Yeah, and I mean that obviously hit miners very hard yesterday.
Yeah.
Miners being obviously big suppliers to China, biggest consumer of commodities anywhere in the world, so miners got hit particularly hard. As they have been for a while, as the story has slowed. But, you know, again, concerns heightened there around that sector. We've got Mark Robinson's commodity page in the magazine this week. Actually, he's found a commodity which isn't getting hit so hard, which is a rare thing these
days.
So he's have a read of that. He's not here in the podcast this week. But, it's also had some knock-on effect potentially to the Federal Reserve's plans to increase interest rates over the US.
Yeah, I mean, they don't struggle to find a reason, it seems, because we've been talking about when they might raise rates for quite a long time now. So perhaps any excuse is available to them, they'll grasp with both hands.
What do you mean? They're sitting there thinking, thank goodness for that.
Yeah. They're sat there before
we're running out of reasons.
What on earth are we going to say to them this time that gives us justification not to do anything yet again? Perhaps this will do that, obviously it could affect the trade balance between the US and China. But yeah, I mean, it seems that...
Well, I think the general worry is that what this suggests is that there are big deflationary pressures around the world still.
Yes.
And therefore, you know, why raise rates when you don't have any inflation to worry about?
Well, exactly, yeah. And, you know, it was Mark Carney in the UK has been talking about the fact that inflation is going to return to 2% relatively quickly, but actually, as yet, it's still pretty flat. So,
absolutely.
And the US is fairly similar picture.
Indeed. I mean, you mentioned the UK wage growth here. I mean, I saw mixed reports of that. Some were saying it's up, some saying it's down, some saying it's, you know, above expectations, some saying it's below expectations. But, I mean, the reality is the data that came out in the UK has kind of, again, pushed the interest rate rise expectation out a little bit further over here as well.
Yeah, possibly. I looked at the wage data and it's broken down in various different ways, as you would expect of the ONS. So the regular pay growth, as they call it, that was unchanged from the previous month. And that's on a rolling three-month basis, I think. But the total pay, which includes bonuses, that did fall. Mm. So it fell from 3.2 to 2.4%. And unemployment remained firm, which isn't a bad thing. I mean, it's a good figure, 5.6%. It's a pretty healthy unemployment.
Yeah, I thought it
number.
Ticked up a little bit, didn't it, unemployment? Just a little bit. I mean,
marginally, yeah. But I think as a percentage, it's pretty much flat.
But,
so,
but what we're not seeing is sort of runaway wage growth and runaway, you know,
no,
job creation.
We're not. I mean, wages are sort of creeping up, and that is a good thing. They have been creeping up in previous months anyway, which is a good thing, obviously, for, you know, UK PLC, for the consumer services sectors in the UK. But yeah, it's not rampant runaway picture just yet.
Yep. So I read, and in fact, I wrote in my editorial, read Capital Economics suggesting that, you know, Q2 16 is looking more likely for a rate rise here.
Yeah, quite credible. I think given what Mark Carney said in his last meeting, it seems that, you know, it wasn't that long ago I was being told that September is probably likely for a UK rate rise, maybe December.
Yeah.
I think you'd struggle to find anyone with that view now.
Absolutely.
The consensus is pretty quickly shifted to 2016.
Well, we've been contrarian all along on this one because we didn't believe it. And what I've written about in my editorial was house builders because they've been hit a couple of times. You've had this little sell-off when worries about interest rate rises have hit that particular sector. And they're going great guns. We had Bellway reporting trading update this week, smashing figures. Yep. You know, it's a tip of ours. It's up in the 70% return so far. But, you know,
it is doing fantastically well. It's a fantastic tip.
Pretty much the same across the sector. Having said that, there's not a big wage growth in the construction industry because they can't get enough builders. And,
no.
I can't get a builder either.
No.
Anyway, if anyone knows a good builder, get in touch.
Your loft needs doing, doesn't it?
It doesn't need doing. That's why I can wait. I want to do it.
But not yet.
But I'm not paying over the odds. I'm not paying, you know, I don't have to.
Have you had a word with these builders?
Oh, God, I've been having many words with these builders.
You told them the economics of the situation.
I don't want to suggest that their services are so in demand that I will accept this quote. So no, I haven't discussed the economics of the construction industry with my builders. I'm just going to find a cheap one. Or wait. Okay. What else we got? You've written something on supermarkets in 7 days.
Indeed. Yep. This was part of came from a broader report by the Share Centre, who do a regular Profit Watch UK report, and basically perhaps unsurprisingly, but the big supermarkets were a very significant drag on profits. Basically, they made profits fall across the whole FTSE 350 because of the amount they lost.
Yeah.
If you take out Tesco, Sainsbury's and Morrison's, I think, and also Vedanta, I think, was an oil company or mining company.
Yeah, Vedanta.
If you take those out, then the picture's a lot better. But obviously, it's convenient to take those out. So, the supermarkets are struggling a lot. Profits are under a lot of pressure there. Obviously, you know, maybe you could argue Tesco is a recovery story, possibly, given it's, you know, sort of aired its dirty laundry now. So maybe that's on the sort of path to recovery. But it seems that the supermarkets are really struggling, given a few things. Price, you know, competition between themselves, but also the rising dominance of things like Aldi and Lidl.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've only been here 3 weeks. So yeah, I guess you haven't had an enormous chance to really dig into the sector. But I presume you've had a little look.
Yeah.
A little look. What are your early thoughts? I mean, you know, is there light at the end of the tunnel?
I think obviously I used to work on Investment Advisor, which is another FT title, and having spoken to a few fund managers about the supermarkets before I came over, you could argue you have to be quite bold to buy Tesco shares now, but arguably pretty much everything's in the price. You know, they've got a new management team. A massive dollop of honesty has been dished out. You know, the picture there is much clearer. Yes, the dividend's been cut, but I guess if you were investing for income and you want some stocks in your portfolio whereby there's a potential for that income to grow, you could argue Tesco is a good bet for that. I think, you know, Tesco is one that I'll be probably looking into. I have to admit, I can't recall off the top of my head what our stance is on Tesco at the moment.
Probably a hold, I would imagine.
Yeah.
It's a hold, yeah.
But I would think that, you know, there's potentially room for that to be reconsidered given it's a long-term thing, but the potential. I mean, I know someone like the income guys at Schroders are very keen on it. They went in pretty much around the bombshell of all this over-accounting thing that went on. So there are fund managers who kind of can see past the noise now, and perhaps they're right.
Okay. Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Okay, and obviously one last piece of big news was Greece, and we seem to be nearing a resolution there of the crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's just getting a bit bored of this now,
aren't
they?
We've been bored of it for months. We always promised we're never going to talk about it, but no, something seems to be happening
that will
put a lot of the worries to rest, at least for a while.
For a while, yes. I mean, reading reports across the press today, it sort of seems that the latest version of the agreement, hopefully it was written on something better than just a hotel notepad like last time, seems to be that it will get passed. It will mean that Greece is going to have to swallow certain conditions, which it obviously the Syriza party had become, it had got into power on the premise that it wouldn't accept any pressure, but obviously it has done. It's had to accept a little bit of pressure. It will have to forego certain things and achieve certain targets.
Like sovereignty.
Yeah, like any self-control, and sell a few assets, that sort of thing.
I don't know how much
the Acropolis is worth.
A couple of islands.
Yeah. who knows? But it seems that we are, as you say, perhaps getting to the end of that tunnel. There is some light there. Does it solve the problem? I don't know. There was a great piece in the FT a few weeks ago about maybe GDP-related bonds would be the best way to go forward. So you kind of restructure the debt so that bondholders are repaid when the country is growing, which would make a lot of sense, actually. It seems to me that this is merely a sticking plaster and we'll be sat here in a few years' time talking about the resurgence of a Greek crisis.
Yeah, well, hopefully not. Or even if there is a resurgence of the Greek crisis, we probably won't be talking about it anyway.
Hopefully by then John will have his conversion.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe we'll get some Greek builders over to okay. Thank you, Bradley.
No worries.
I mean, in the news section as well, which you've looked after very ably this week, Bradley, yep. Big stories from your sector, Ian, particularly around the annuity providers, Partnership Assurance and Just Retirement, who got smashed after George Osborne's surprise announcement. God, how long ago was that now? 6 months? A year?
No, that was last year's budget.
Was it last
year? 2014 budget. So a while ago now. So yeah, this is another ripple from that. Obviously, we saw the Aviva and Friends Life tie-up shortly after that budget. And that was obviously partly to do with the kind of imminent contraction in the annuity market in the UK. And now we've seen Just Retirement and Partnership Assurance, which provide these kind of specialist annuities, medically underwritten annuities, and they also do bulk annuities, which are where companies want to offload risk from their pension scheme, so in a bulk annuity sale, so bulk annuity insurance contract. They've decided to kind of get together because that market has been shrinking as a result of the budget. Rather than kind of fight it out, there's been an all-share merger agreed between the two parties. It looks to be a sensible thing to do. Partnership shares got a brief fillip on the back of the result, back of the report, but they also came out with their results on the same day. And after, I think, analysts in the market digested just how bad the numbers are for Partnership in terms of the loss on new business they made over the first half, then the kind of optimism faded away quite quickly and shares ended up about the same level. So this is not a panacea in terms of the challenges faced by these two companies, but it is probably a sensible step in terms of there's some kind of cost savings that they can achieve. Yeah, and also they won't be kind of fighting over the same contracts.
Mm.
But basically a stock picker's view on either of the companies has to be based on an evaluation of the annuity market, both in on the individual side and on the bulk side. And they're both very hard to predict at the moment as to kind of where the business is going to come from.
I mean, a number of other insurers have reported this week. Are they suffering from the same uncertainty in terms of the way the market is going to pan out?
Well, a lot of the life insurers in the UK have done really well is to kind of steer away and reposition their businesses away from individual annuities, either to these bulk annuities that I described, or to income drawdown or to other kind of fee earning products. But actually, UK life business for Aviva the first half and Prudential was actually quite strong. So there is still some good business here. Partnership in its quarter by quarter numbers showed an uptick in individual annuity sales in the second quarter compared to the first quarter. And that's the first time that's happened in about four or five quarters. So we could be seeing the recovery of the individual annuity market, or at least partial recovery, following a lot of people pausing their retirement decisions in the midst of this big reform. Or we could just see a momentary flip there. And on the bulk annuity side, it's just very difficult to predict. But there's a huge amount of these pension liabilities that need to be insured at some point. So this market is going to take off. It's just who's going to win the business and how lumpy is it going to be? When's it going to come through? So
Yeah. I mean, I think at the time we felt the partnership in Just Retirement had been probably oversold. When the news came out, and I think, did we have them on a buy?
We had partnership on a buy, and that did quite well on the back of this. As I say, after the half-year results, then they kind of fell back again when people looked at the numbers.
It's definitely the share price is up from where it was.
It's had a better start to the year. If you look at the graph in our story, and you see that they've had a recovery in partnership. Yeah, so we think that it was overdone as a result of the budget concerns, and that there is some strength in that business. Mm. But the way the business works, a lot of their costs are against new business generation, and that's why partnership is struggling, because that kind of loss on new business they're seeing. So they don't want to kind of cut costs from that side of it in terms of generating the new business, because they're hoping the bulk annuity market is very lumpy and they'll get some bigger deals in the second half, and they're hoping the individual annuity market's going to come back. But there's a lot of uncertainty around there. So these are probably speculative decisions.
But it's not dead entirely. I mean, you know, a year ago, the talk was that the individual annuity market was finished. Yeah, that nobody would buy these things.
It's definitely not dead. There's still a huge appetite, if you survey people, for a guaranteed retirement income, which is what an annuity is. It's just the word annuity in the product has been kind of tied up with this lack of freedom, and you've had the reform, and a lot of people do want an income drawdown product. They want to be able to take some money out, and they want a bit more of a flexible retirement income. You know, people sometimes want, they talk about a U-shaped retirement. You want money at the beginning and you maybe need money at the end, rather than an annuity. Sometimes, you know, it'll be a level kind of payment that you'll get.
It sounds like the market just needs to adapt to what the consumer actually wants, and they're in a good position to do that, essentially.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it depends whether these kind of individually underwritten annuities kind of come back to the fore, which they might well do. In terms of the wider market, Standard Life and others that have kind of a good income drawdown proposition are really benefiting, because obviously people want to be able to take a more flexible income from their retirement pot. Mm. So there's a mixture of people that want certainty and a mixture of people that want flexibility. But these life insurers are adapting. But we've seen these specialist annuity providers hit because they don't provide as many of the other products that the bigger life insurers do.
Okay. I particularly liked your Prudential piece this week, Ian. I thought it was a fantastic opening paragraph.
I thought you'd like it, John. It started with the name of a few famous footballers.
Who did we have?
We had Gianluca Vialli.
Gianluca Vialli.
Glenn Hoddle. Ruud Gullit, which listeners who follow football will know.
Indeed.
What unites all those people? Dom?
It. Scum. No, Chelsea.
What also unites them in terms of their role at the club at one point?
Managers.
What kind of managers have they been?
Come on, you're the football expert here.
They've been player managers. So the reason I made that comparison is that Mike Wells, who's the chief executive of Prudential, on the morning half-year results call, described himself as a bit of a player that's become a coach at Prudential. Obviously, he's the head of the US business. He's now taken over from a very successful CEO. And so kind of describes himself as a kind of player coach. So that's why I made that comparison there. But yeah, he's inherited a good team. Is what I've said. He's also got a strong set of overseas players, if I can stretch the analogy a little bit too far. in terms of the Asia business, has still been incredibly strong. So yeah, Prudential is still a business that's performing well, but because of its emerging market, especially its Asia exposure, it has actually suffered on the share price in 2015. So yeah, Prudential, but a pretty good set of figures, and we remain positive on it.
Okay, there you go. And while we're on the subject of results, Bradley, you've been picking them up, and you joined also at the wonderful time of results season. So
you chucked me into the deep end, basically. I've been swimming okay.
You've been swimming all right. That's the way we like to do it. So you have taken over from Harriet, the gambling sector.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You've covered the two big guys this week. They're having a bit of a torrid time at the moment.
Yeah, it's a tough industry anyway. Obviously, you have headwinds of the point of consumption tax, which is aimed at making, they could make some money out of internet-based gambling companies, I suppose.
Yeah, so a lot of them were based in Gibraltar before, wasn't it?
Absolutely. They would register offshore deliberately. So, I mean, I think it's perhaps a bit cynical to say it's a way for the government to make money, because quite frankly, these companies, some of which have pure online business models, weren't paying any tax whatsoever in the UK, even though the majority of their business is sold to UK consumers. So as much as, the government's now making, it's got 15% duty on it now, that's, in my view, that's fair enough. These companies weren't paying tax.
Must have done horrible things to the Gibraltar economy. I remember going out there and half the expats seem to work for Victor Chanda or one of those firms. So
I mean, they have a whole association built up out there, of which most of the gambling companies you come across are members of. They staged, I think, two separate legal challenges last year, both of which failed catastrophically. So, it didn't help, I don't think, that it was really in the headlines at the same time as Amazon and Starbucks and all of that sort of hoo-ha going on at the same time. It was never going
to
win.
Hard to feel any sympathy for companies that make their money from gambling, though. Yeah. But anyways, listen, a lot of people do own the shares.
Yeah,
How are they getting on? Point of consumption tax is here. It's obviously had a big hit. What do we think the prospects look like now?
So they're both struggling because of the headwinds we've mentioned so far. So there's a point of consumption tax. There's also a large machine game duty, which was increased by the government back end of last year. So that's hit profits for the groups as well. William Hill has bought a company called Neo Games. It's bought a stake in it. It has an option to buy the rest of it. Neo Games is an online lottery company. And I think William Hill's hoping this will kind of help it in some way. But I mean, it's a small business so far. Neo Games has just one license to operate a state lottery in the US. Four states so far have the ability to run an online state lottery. More are likely to follow.
It's kind of an interesting deal in light of the fact it tried to buy 888 at the beginning of the year, obviously a much bigger company, and that would have been a public company takeover, and it completely failed to do that. 888 was like, you've got to be joking, basically. And 888 has a huge US operation as well, so it's very clear what William Hill's trying to do. I think it's very clear that it needs to buck up the end of its online business, and it's clear that it wants to go deeper into the US as well.
US would trouble me because many years ago, obviously, the US was a great market for online gambling companies. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, the law changed. There was a change of government, and actually, it wasn't just banned. Retrospective activity became illegal and people were prosecuted.
And the federal system, I think, in the US is just so hard to navigate for, especially for foreign companies trying to go in. It's a lot of the analysts that you speak to in the city are very bullish on the US. If there's a company going after US operations, they see that as a huge growth area and they get all over excited. I personally don't get that excited. I worry more for them because the cost is huge and the progress is achingly slow. And people like Sportech, who Bradley you're going to come up against later in the year, they're just prime examples of companies that have been doing this for years, and the share price just goes all over the place. You have to be you have to buckle up.
These are interesting looking share price graphs.
Ladbrokes as well. I was just looking at the Ladbrokes one as well. It fell into a pre-tax loss of this period that's just reported. It's obviously hoping on the subject of M&A, I suppose, it's proposed a merger with Gala Coral. All being well, this will go ahead perfectly fine, but there is still the chance that the Competition and Markets Authority could throw a spanner in the works, or somebody else could come along and bid for either. I mean, Ladbrokes could be bid for, or Gala Coral could be bid for by somebody else. So I think Ladbrokes, again, it's hoping that a merger will help it revive, basically. But the shares, if you look at the share price graph in our magazine this week, on page 58, it's a pretty steep drop.
for what it's worth, Mr. Bearball, who runs an income portfolio, he stuck with Ladbrokes for a long time. He's sold out now.
My predecessor, Julian Hoffman, if anyone used to follow his advice, he actually had Ladbrokes on a buy for a very long time as a takeover target. Funnily enough, that was the basis of his argument. Yeah. Of course, it never came to fruition in the last 18 months or so. So I think we had eventually revised our position to hold. Yeah. But maybe he was just slightly ahead of the curve there because it obviously has materialized.
When I covered the sector, I always went for Hills and sold Ladbrokes. I thought, yeah, Ladbrokes was so far behind online.
And the two, I think, are just at a massive disadvantage in the market because they're the two that are fighting on two fronts. You know, not only do they have to navigate online, they have to, you know, manage a retail estate at the same time, which will be very large
if they merge as well. And I think analysts have said that actually Ladbrokes could improve its online proposition if it copied what Gala Coral did. So there's obviously a rationale behind the merger. So, you know, there's a reason it could be good. It could mean that the online presence for both companies is better. But as Harriet rightly says, you know, having such a large estate, it can be positive or negative. Machines are, you know, money-making machines for gambling companies, but they come with a big tax as well, and you know, you've got to maintain property. It's costly.
The regulation environment is only ever going to get worse for gambling companies. It's never going to get better. So you know, you've got to brace for that, and it's going to be about, I think a lot of the management will be tested on how well they control costs ultimately. It's not, you know, it's not rocket science at the end of the day. Jim Mullen has quite a task ahead of him at Ladbrokes either way, I think.
Yes.
As you say, the estate's going to be enormous if they do merge, so it's not like merging with Coral is the end of their woes.
Absolutely not.
No, and I think he said 2017 before you can expect to see any recovery.
Which is maybe a nice bit of honesty there. Harriet said, he has a plan. He used to be the chief operating officer at William Hill, so he's got credibility behind him, perhaps, given that. But it's going to be a little while before there is visible improvement in his opinion. So we remain on hold for the moment. I think that might be the case for a while.
Yeah, okay. One sector that is having a bit of a better time, while we're on results still, is car retail.
Yeah.
We've talked about this a few times. We had some results this week from Lucas. They were great. You covered them, Harry.
Yeah, really, really great. I have to say, though, I have to give props to Pendragon and Inchcape that came week before as well. Both sort of pretty good. Inchcape, bit more of a mixed bag, but it's a much more global business. So, you kind of have to cut them a bit of slack there.
Yeah.
Lookers, obviously, very UK-centric business. And what I like about car retail is it's quite straightforward in terms of if the economy is doing well and wages are returning to growth, even if they are, it's a slow return, generally the car retail market follows. And that's exactly what we've seen at Lookers this week.
Yeah. People need new cars.
They need new cars. They want used cars. They want after sales and they want parts.
You want to listen to my car. It's making a noise that you wouldn't believe.
Yeah. I mean,
Still goes.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to go for much longer. Sorry, this is my old car, because as listeners will know, I did buy another car.
So how many cars? How many cars do you have then?
Two. So I have to drive to the station now. I moved house. I've got the old car, and the old car is making this incredible noise.
Sounds delightful.
I ought to get it fixed, but just worried how much it's going to cost me. Car also, Lookers.
Yeah. And their balance sheet's looking the best it has for years, according to their finance chief.
Another way to play that is through the motor finance providers that have had an absolutely brilliant time. I was just speaking to the chief exec of Friends Provident earlier. Of Provident Financial. Get my Providence right around. I was just talking to the chief executive of the Provident Financial earlier, who was they've bought this Money Barn business, which is growing really well. SNU, which is a TIP, has done really well on the motor finance side. Not so good for the motor insurers, actually, where premiums still really tough market, and we reported on eShore this week. Not a good time to be a motor insurer, as there's more cars being driven, there's more people doing longer, more mileage because of petrol's cheaper, and we've also seen a rise in whiplash claims. Whiplash claims are back. I think the government tried to intervene in the market, and it hasn't been so successful.
That's good news for Queen Dell, isn't it? Isn't that what they are?
They need some good news.
Need a longer podcast for that.
Oh yeah, let's not talk about that too much. Talking of alternative lenders, Paragon issued a retail bond this weekend.
Seamless link.
Seamless.
Yeah.
That's the way we roll.
Yeah, and they're no stranger to retail bond offerings. But it's a good opportunity to have access to the buy-to-let mortgage market, mortgage lending market, and also consumer finance where Paragon operates. So yeah, it's a 6% coupon it's offering. And yeah, so there's plenty of detail about it because we know that retail bond offerings are popular with our readers, and Paragon's a company that we like. In terms of what it says about the business, it just shows that these times are good for the alternative lenders and they're taking steps to improve their funding all the time. So reducing their cost of debt and expanding their kind of sources of funding, and it's just another example of it.
Well, apparently this bond issue will close at noon on the 24th of August. I predict that we won't even get anywhere near that before this one sells out.
No, if you look at the yield compared to what you can get on a government bond, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, the all market is a bit weaker, has been a bit weaker of late. There was a flood of issuance, you know, in the first couple of years this thing, the London Stock Exchange retail bond market came into existence. It kind of slowed up, and I think that was partly because people were worried about interest rate increases and that retail bonds would become comparatively unattractive, and that seems to have gone away for a
while.
If
you look at their last two retail bond issuances, they're both trading in advance of par value, so you know the capital value is holding up well on the bonds.
Even above par, you're still getting a better yield than you are savings on a bank account or whatever it might be. I wonder if we'll see a few more of those in the months ahead. Harriet, I mean, this is a subject which is both petrifying and fascinating at the same time. So what we talked about doing was looking at some of the biotechs and some of the large pharma companies, specialty pharma companies out there who are looking at finding cures for diseases which, you know, the most frightening diseases, the ones that we all worry about a lot. And so we're going to run a series of these things, but you've started
with the big boy.
With the big C.
Have done. Yeah. It's a really interesting subject because, of course, in terms of broadsheet headlines, it's bandied around an awful lot. And I think when you're trying to find an investment angle for this, it's a very unique challenge because you have to really try and understand what you're investing in. And I think you have to understand the shortcomings of the industry at the moment as well. And you shouldn't be taken in by those headlines that say so-and-so has found the cure for cancer.
And we do hear them quite a lot. I mean, you know, as I was driving to work in my second car the other day, you know, there was a story about a new treatment that, you know, pretty much, you know, cured someone of some hideous cancer they had. And morning radio kind of thing you want to hear on your way to work. But it's not that simple.
It's really not that simple. And I think I say in the opening paragraph of this feature, you know, have we found a cure for cancer? In short, the answer is no, absolutely not. However, what we are finding are sort of glimmers of hope. And maybe that's a bit sort of you know, romantic or what have you, but ultimately there are ways to invest in this space and realistic ways. But I do spend quite a bit of the first part of the feature explaining exactly what the new frontier in cancer treatment is, which is immuno-oncology. To put it simply, I do go into more detail in the feature, but to put it simply, it's basically using patients' immune systems to fight off their disease. And the point is that unfortunately, cancer is unique, and that's really what's holding the industry
back. To
each individual case, pretty much. It doesn't matter if you have breast cancer. It's highly dependent on what kind of breast cancer tumour you have and what it's going to respond to. And this is where sort of drugs that harness the immune system are proving more effective because they're more tailored to a patient's individual sort of makeup as such. And I go on to the feature to explain genomics as well. There are gene therapies that are using, again, people's individual sort of gene makeup to fight their disease. You know, cancer is ultimately a series of gene mutations. So it's about finding those mutations and trying to make these treatments as targeted as possible. Unfortunately, that makes, you know, most of the treatments very expensive, and certainly the development extremely expensive as well.
Now, we talked a couple of weeks ago in our healthcare tech feature about how big data is kind of helping a lot of this stuff along. I know you haven't talked about that here.
No, not really.
Because we did that a couple of weeks ago. But this must be helping. So, you know, if you're trying to analyse this level of data on an individual basis, being able to crunch the numbers that much more quickly must help a great deal. So the ability to target and to build these personal medicines is improving all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And bringing the cost down.
Yeah,
well.
Certainly. And I think this is what I've sort of tried to explain in the feature as well, is that you don't just have to invest in a pharma company or even a biotech company to get exposure in this space. Diagnostics, which is another part of the healthcare tech feature that I looked at, is sort of repeated here in that you can invest in these diagnostic companies that are developing little bits of kit, basically, that are going to cut down sort of the time taken between a patient coming and presenting symptoms to being diagnosed with this is your kind of cancer, because obviously that has a huge bearing as well on how well they're going to respond to treatment.
So early warning stuff as well.
Yeah, and I mean, Akers Bioscience is one of the companies that I sort of cite in this. They develop, at the moment, it's sort of still in testing mode, but they are developing what are essentially, hopefully, breathalyzers, typically used in, you know, alcohol detection when you're behind the wheel and things like that. But eventually they want to come up with similar sorts of tests that could detect if you have lung cancer.
This is the oxidative stress point. I thought it was fascinating, actually.
It is fascinating.
Finding that correlation there between a sort of reading on a breathalyzer test and certain disease, I thought it was amazing.
It is amazing, and it's really pioneered in the US, as most healthcare development is. And although it's still fairly embryonic, they are hoping that there'll be certain sort of markers that come out of these tests that suggest these patients could have, you know, bigger problems than they might suspect, and that'll just cut down the diagnosis time. In which case, you know, as is well known, your chances are better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you say the US is the big market for development here, but one company you've talked about is Hutchinson China Meditech, and China is becoming a force to be reckoned with here too.
Yeah, absolutely. Hutchinson China Meditech is a great company, and I've liked them for a long time, but it's one of these companies that has basically just a non-existent valuation. So in terms of recommending shares, it's difficult. But I think what's interesting about China is that it's a hugely untapped patient market. There's a growing middle class in China that are willing to pay for these sorts of treatments. There's also a sweep of healthcare reforms going on out there in terms of insurance coverage and things like that, which are really driving a lot of growth over there. And it's cheaper to develop over there as well. If they can get clinical trials through in China, it sort of limits them perhaps on where they might be able to sell that drug eventually. But I think on the whole, it's perhaps a much more fast growing market than the US.
And I thought it was quite interesting that they've got a big tie up with one of the big US pharma giants, Eli Lilly. Mm. But this seems to be a feature of the way drugs are being developed now. You've got Oxford Biomedica working with Novartis, and obviously GSK, who's teamed up with a small company in Oxford to develop oncology treatments. Yeah. So the whole partnership thing, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was really born out of the recession a lot. You know, in the mid-2000s, the drugs companies were coming under a lot of pressure in the amount they were spending on in-house R&D. And I think a lot of them have decided that it's, in a way, it's cheaper to team up with the biotechs, let them, you know, sort of take the cost 50-50 and see what they can come up with together. It's interesting that you mentioned GSK as well, because as followers of the stock will know, they sold off their entire oncology unit to Novartis last year. So and then this oncology deal with the Oxford-based biotech came about 3 weeks after that. So you can see a very definite shift in their business model about how they're going to look at cancer. But, you know, there's a lot of conflicting opinion in Big Pharma as well about whether they, quote, bother to get into cancer, because it is so costly and the risk of failure is massive. And, you know, I've spoken to several industry insiders in this respect, and all of them say words to the same effect, which is, we're not running a charity. If you want to invest money where you don't expect to give a return to investors, then you have to donate to, you know, Cancer Research UK or whoever. If you're going to give funds to a public company, that public company has a duty to give a return to its shareholder. So profits and cancer is kind of a really interesting moral issue as well that readers will have to come to their own opinion on.
Yeah, I think though, when you look across the board, you've got Big Pharma and the way they're approaching it, and you've obviously got biotechs at the other end, and they're kind of meeting in the middle. But I think you've got a business model for everybody here, depending on the level of risk you want to take on.
Absolutely. That's what I've tried to sort of get at in the feature, is there are different levels of doing it. Obviously, Astra and GSK, some of the safest plays in terms of, I think both shares yield about 5%. So you're almost guaranteed a return just off the regular dividend there. Mm. Biotech obviously has nowhere near that structure, and you're eventually waiting for a big sale, usually to a big pharma partner. They'll just buy it out completely if they like it. Or even a commercial launch. I mean, it's not cancer, but GW Pharma, which is interesting, it's a British company, but it's a lot more US focused now since it went over to NASDAQ. And that's one where they literally set up life as a biotech almost, and they're really focused on turning themselves into, quote, specialty pharma, which basically means they've got their own products, they've got their own technology, they've got their own in-house R&D, and they're not interested in selling their product off to a big pharma partner. They want to take it all the way to the market themselves.
So, well, good luck to them.
Yeah.
Good luck to them. Okay, anyway, it's a fascinating feature. I mean, it really is a cracking read. Thank you very much, Harriet. And as I said, we'll be following this feature up with some other... looking at some other areas of treatment, Alzheimer's, potentially diabetes, I would
HIV,
imagine is a big one, HIV. So, yeah, I mean, it's a difficult industry to get to grips with if you're a non-expert.
Yeah.
And I think the aim is to really help people understand what's out there on the market.
Bit
so,
of education.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay. So, we've been talking for ages. This podcast has flown by, just like your first 3 weeks, Bradley. So
exactly.
Thank you all very much again. Thank you, Bradley, for coming along today for the first time.
No, thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Harriet, and thank you over in the control room, Ian. Plenty of the magazine this week. Results season is winding down, but it's still fairly busy. So a few results there. Sex Focus, which you've also written, Bradley.
And I did, on the hotel sector. An interesting one. I encourage you to read that. And if you want to even see me talk about it, I did a video with Mark this morning.
First video. I hear it went very well. So, have a look at that on the website. Algie Hall is looking in stock screen at cheap small caps. Rosie has followed up her... her wills and estate planning article with another this week on inheritance tax. Obviously, lots in the funds and personal finance section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. But that is kind of, in short, everything's in the magazine. Tips, news, obviously. And go and pick it up. £4.50, all good news agents. And we'll speak again next week. Thank you very much. Goodbye.